It's next in 76-260, Lefkowitz, Attorney General against Cunningham. If you'd like, we've had some very tall down on the side here. We've had some very tall counsel preceding you today. See, Mr. Galt.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this is an appeal by the Attorney General of New York. A defendant below was also charged, of course, with the responsibility of defending the constitutionality of state statutes from a judgment of a three-judge court in the Southern District of New York. The judgment below declared Section 22 of the state's election law unconstitutional and enjoined its enforcement against the appellee as being violative of the federal constitution under the Fifth Amendment. In relevant part and in essence, the statute in dispute provides that the refusal of a political party officer to waive immunity from criminal prosecution when called before a grand jury to testify with respect to the conduct of his political office thereupon affects a termination of tenure of the office and also invokes a disqualification beginning then and there from holding for a period of 5 years thereafter any party or public office. And parenthetically, I might note that the type of immunity which is mandated by the New York statutes, the New York criminal procedure law, when a witness testifies under immunity before a grand jury, is not simply use immunity, but full transactional immunity. Now, the salient facts of the case are few and I think undisputed.
Just to make just to get the facts clear, what these people would be requested to do is not just to waive transactional immunity, but to waive use immunity or any kind of immunity.
No, they're being asked to waive immunity of any kind. They would get...
That's what I said.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you, Justice White. But they would get, if they
did receive immunity, they would get
full transactional immunity, yeah, not merely use
immunity. I know, but the state didn't say to them, by the way, we would be satisfied to leave you with use immunity.
The federal constitution merely requires, of course,
the state said, whatever... We demand that you waive immunity broadly.
That's right.
And we would not be satisfied to have you retain use immunity.
Well, I don't know whether it's spelled out in so many words, Mr. Justice White. It was not here, but of course that would be clear. And in fact, as I think I will have occasion...
The waiver demanded waived use immunity as well as anything else.
That's right. Waives all immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Waives waives the immunity which he would have, which would be transactional immunity if he got immunity.
Yes, I guess so.
Now, of course, it's relevant to let the court know that at the time this action was begun, under 42 U.S.C. section 1983, the appellee held, and the action arose out of his holding of, four party offices defined and recognized as such under New York law. First of all, very recently this changed. He was state chairman of the State Democratic Party in New York and a member of its executive committee. He was and is also chairman of the Bronx County Democratic Executive Committee and a member of that committee also. And it was only after the briefs were filed in this case, may I note, that Mr. Cunningham stepped down from one of these offices, that of state chairman of the State Democratic Party. But important connection it would be to note that party officers and even high party officers like Mr. Cunningham are not elected either by the electorate at large or the Democratic electorate, but by a relative handful, in fact, a real handful of other party officers. Now, as state chairman, and this is true of the state committee itself, there are many formal functions which New York law attaches to those offices, connected, of course, principally with the electoral process. But informally, and aside from that, I need hardly remind this court of the great power, the great influence, the tremendous prestige which the chairman of a state political party has. And in this instance, the Democratic Party rules in the state of New York explicitly denominate the chairman of the state party as the top leader of the Democratic Party in New York. And there are, I think at pages 3 to 4 of our brief, we've outlined these functions. And the same with respect to his chairmanship of the Bronx County Democratic Executive Committee, also a very powerful office, and one which exerts considerable influence, and one which will make its influence felt, I think, too, in the, as a great county organization, in the upcoming nominations for the mayoralty campaign, which will take place in 1977 in the city of New York. But in tandem, the holding of these two offices, these two party offices, represents a great deal of power on the part of the holder of the office, or of these offices. And I need hardly elaborate on that. I do wish to point out to the court that in none of these party offices was Mr. Cunningham salaried, or is he salaried. There is no emolument of any kind, no consideration of any kind, which he received from any of his party officers. And
if you prevailed,
pardon?
If you prevailed, Mr. Galt, would the person in the position of Mr. Cunningham be barred from being a delegate to the national convention of his party in a 5-year period?
That's not holding party office. At least quite sure it is not. As a matter of fact, if Your Honor is touching upon, and you may be at this point, touching upon the freedom of association argument, in that respect there would be no play for the argument because he would be free to do anything he wishes other than being barred from the office itself or from party office. He can counsel as much as he wants, advise, do anything he wishes with respect to his fellow Democrats. The statute doesn't bar him from that.
Well,
and I'm sure he could be elected a delegate.
I had no
I would hardly that's not defined as a party office in New York.
I had no particular scope in mind. I just wanted to know how far was the reach of the statute. But you think it would not bar him from being a delegate?
I'm quite sure it would not. I would almost be positive in that respect. Now, I do think it pertinent to mention before going on that at all times, at all of these times, Mr. Cunningham was and is an attorney in active practice in the city of New York. Now, when in December 1975 a subpoena was first served upon Mr. Cunningham by the then special prosecutor in charge of investigating the criminal justice system in New York, that subpoena was resisted. An action was brought immediately in the state courts to quash the subpoena on various grounds, including the Fifth Amendment, First Amendment, Fifth Amendment, and 14th Amendment grounds urged here, went all the way through the state courts to the highest appellate level in the state, and Mr. Cunningham was unsuccessful. And so, as it happened, he finally appeared before the grand jury on April 12th of last year, at which time, presented with a waiver of immunity to sign, he refused to sign it and did not testify. And, of course, the operation of that statute would be automatic, and he would have been barred immediately from his party offices and from holding the other offices I have mentioned for 5 years, but immediately brought this action in the Southern District of New York, and on the very same afternoon, April 13th, before a single district judge, we argued the matter on the question of a TRO. A TRO was issued. There were greatly expedited proceedings before the three-judge court, and in a matter of almost days, the case had been argued and the decision rendered below. And that decision, as I've indicated, was to strike down the statute, Section 22, as unconstitutional on Fifth Amendment grounds without the court having reached, however, the First Amendment claim. And in so doing, the court specifically said that Section 22 of the New York election law is similar in operation to the statute struck down in the aforementioned cases, being, of course, and I'm interpolating this, the Garrity case, Garrity against New Jersey, in 385 U.S. and continuing on through this court's 1973 decision in Lefkowitz against Turley in 414 U.S., going back to what they said, the statute struck down in the aforementioned cases in that it, meaning Section 22, conditions tenure in office upon the forfeiture of the privilege against self-incrimination. As such, it would appear to fail to measure up to constitutionally accepted standards.
Is there anything in the record to show what they were investigating?
No, but it's undisputed. I think there is in the... I think it's indicated in the petition that was brought. We filed no papers, Mr. Justice Marshall. There wasn't time. We merely submitted a brief and argued. But I don't think it will be disputed that this was what the grand jury was investigation. Was investigating. That's never been a bone of contention. The propriety of its investigation is not in contention.
Shouldn't it be? Suppose that I don't like you and I just give you a subpoena.
Well, of course, Justice Marshall...
Well, how under the New York procedure, in the New York courts, could he try this, the merits?
He brought a motion to quash that subpoena on the same grounds as here, if, and including many others, I know. But if that were the case, it would have been raised and disposed of there. But there is no such question here. We're raising, I think, a non-realistic issue in that regard, if I may say so, Justice Marshall, because that is not in dispute in this case. There's no question
what
here.
What do you mean it's not in dispute?
There's no dispute.
It's not in dispute that there is no reason to bring him before the grand jury?
No. It's not in dispute that this grand jury, he was brought before this grand jury to inquire into the conduct of his party office. There's absolutely no dispute about that.
That's all.
Well, that would be the ball game. That's right. Now, the question presented is whether New York's interest in maintaining the integrity of its political process and in preventing corruption or even the appearance of corruption in its political system entitles it, with respect particularly to the appellee, a very prominent non-salaried party official, to yield his party offices if he fails to waive immunity in connection with a grand jury inquiry into the conduct of his party office. And that question, I submit, is a very vital one, not only to the state of New York and its citizens, but to this court and indeed really to the nation at large, because we are in very much so. One would not dispute that, but the very grave interests here at play, Mr. Justice Marshall, I think cannot be overlooked. And in the course of argument, without any denigration of Mr. Cunningham's rights, I will try to indicate, if possible, that the state of New York acted with perfect propriety here. And as we go on, I think, Your Honor, and I hope I may have the benefit of your consideration in this regard, we will show that the state of New York has a perfectly constitutional statute in Section 22. Because, as everyone knows, we have just been through an era, and we may not have emerged from it yet, in which the nation witnessed the spectacle, and that's not an exaggerated word, spectacle, of very high party officers abandoning their office in the midst of scandal and corruption, and scenes of scandal and corruption that I think have been unparalleled. And not only that, unparalleled too has been the growth of public cynicism, public distrust of politicians and of political office and of political parties. In fact, it's an everyday thing, commonplace. You can speak to any man in the street, and he will tell you that all politicians are not to be trusted. Now, New York was quick to respond to that situation, just as did the federal government in 1974, when it enacted the Federal Campaign Contributions Act, which this court upheld in very large part in Buckley against Valeo in 324 U.S. last year. So New York enacted a campaign finance reform law and contributions law with a new state board of election designed to see to it that the political process would be responsive to the needs and demands of the citizenry. It also enacted in 1974, the same year, a public information law. And in 1976, it enacted an open meetings law, which would extend to every public agency in the state, even down to and including the smallest fire or special service district.
Mr. Gauld, was this Section 22 a part of that series of enactments?
No. Section 72 was enacted, I think, in 1953 or somewhere around that time. And I must say, Justice Stevens, that we must have regard to the fact that it was enacted by whom? The legislature, which, of course, has representatives of political parties. Its members are representatives of political parties. And the political parties knowingly enacted this statute. And while it predated these reform measurements, Section 22 has the same aim and endeavor, and that is to maintain the confidence of the people in the political process and in representative government. And I think that it's fair to say that Section 22 is patently designed to avoid the spectacle of high officials and high party officers refusing to account for their activities in party office under oath, and doing that with impunity because they feel that they need not waive immunity. And they can then, if they testify under immunity, no matter what they testify to, no matter how the acts may violate the criminal law, then of course they are forever immune from prosecution on the transaction unless testimony of an entirely different nature of a new situation should arise.
Couldn't they be subpoenaed before the legislature to testify as to all this corruption?
Perhaps he could be subpoenaed. Yes, he could, I'm pretty sure, be subpoenaed before a legislative inquiry, but Justice Marshall... Yes? Because the grand jury is authorized to inquire into criminal acts, number one, and the grand jury is the only body of citizens, of regular, ordinary citizens, before whom the party officer can be brought. Legislative committees are not ordinary citizens.
The grand jury didn't subpoena this man.
Pardon?
You and I know that, quote, the grand jury, end quote, didn't subpoena him. This special prosecutor subpoenaed him. Am I right?
Well, I think the special prosecutor did subpoena him, but there's no question
that
before the grand jury. That's correct. There is another special prosecutor there now, but and of a different political party, for that matter.
Mr. Gall, let me just get myself straight now. You say he could have been called before a legislative committee, but could he not have taken the Fifth Amendment had he done so?
Oh, yes, because the statute...
So they couldn't have compelled him to testify either, could they?
Well, he would. They could have required him to waive immunity.
Section under this statute. I mean, this... in other words, what's the distinction between the grand jury and the legislative committee? I don't understand. They're both referred to in the statute.
The legislative committee, merely if it wishes to, and I don't know of any legislative inquiry into this sort of situation, certainly not recently. There may have been, but I don't know of any. But a legislative committee undertakes such studies, theoretically at least, and avowedly at least, for the purpose of determining whether there needs to be amendment to legislation. If there's going to be anything of criminal consequence involved in the situation...
No, I understand that, but what I don't understand why it would make any difference whether this case had arisen before a legislative committee instead of the grand jury.
It doesn't
make
any difference.
Precisely the same issue, wouldn't we?
It doesn't make any difference.
But Section 22...
Except that... Pardon?
Section 22 explicitly applies to an inquiry
That's
by
right.
a legislative committee.
That's right.
It does so.
But the only difference it might make is one of degree, because I think with the grand jury constituting a body of citizens, one of its traditional and most important historical functions, that of acting as surrogate for the people, the matter assumes a great deal more seriousness and is of greater consequence to the proper operation of the political system in New York. Now, we've spoken of use immunity before, and it's Mr. Cunningham's, or one of Mr. Cunningham's answers in this argument before the court, that were he to be granted simply use immunity, that he would be willing to do. He would testify under use rather than transactional immunity. That's how I understand his brief to argue. Aside from the fact that there's serious question as to whether use immunity could be had in a grand jury proceeding under New York law, I pass to the more important thing. If that were so, if he could have use immunity and not relinquish his party offices, and testify under use immunity, and unless other evidence were to be forthcoming from other sources going beyond the scope of the use immunity, the public distrust would only be greatly enhanced, greatly exacerbated, because to them,
well,
this would be...
Use immunity wouldn't... Would only be of use in a criminal prosecution.
That's right.
Not in any removal proceedings from a public office.
No. I was saying that if he would give the use immunity, he would do that in exchange for not being removed from public office. He would testify under use immunity. He might ultimately be removed from public office if he were ever to be indicted and convicted of a crime. But...
We'll resume at that point in the morning. We'll resume arguments in Lefkowitz against Cunningham. Mr. Gould?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, in continuing, I should like to stress why the grant of use immunity to Mr. Cunningham would be totally unacceptable to the public. They would undoubtedly view it as a situation simply of two politicians conspiring together for the purpose of having one of them confer immunity upon the other in exchange for an agreement to confess. This, of course, would heighten public suspicion and distrust of politicians in general, and the very idea that a party officer can only be compelled to account for his performance in office only on the condition that he will be forever insulated from prosecution for his misdeeds is repellent. It's repugnant to any concept of justice, and I think an outrage which the Constitution could never have intended nor condone. And I think New York should certainly be permitted to convince its citizens that they can control the political process, and that they need not let politicians go scot-free simply in return for the truth as to the exercise of the public trust imposed in them. Now, in this case, certainly, Mr. Cunningham loses no employment, loses no right to continue in his professional practice, should he relinquish his party offices. And in this sense, there is a very significant distinction from the Garrity line of cases, in each of which there was substantial economic reprisal as the price for the exercise of the Fifth Amendment privilege. And it makes this case, I think, much more closely resemble the fairly recent decision of this court, last April, I believe, in Baxter against Parmigiano, where it was said by this court that a negative effect without substantial economic penalty is a consequence constitutionally permissible under the Fifth Amendment. And there's another very sharp difference among many others from the Garrity line of cases. There is no doubt whatever that Mr. Cunningham and his state and county chairmanships were and are very conspicuous, very visible, highly visible, and very easily identifiable in the public eye, a factor which was not present in any of the Garrity line of cases. Now, I know that this court has recognized that the Fifth Amendment is intended to protect the innocent as well as the guilty, and also that the invoking of the privilege doesn't promote, but rather tends to detract from, the truth-finding process. And in these circumstances, one may well...